And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness. The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
This is Phil Lairness coming at you from Los Angeles, where it's startlingly bright early in this morning. And you here playing with Tinker Toys, none other
Tinker Toys
than TV's Dean Haglund coming at you from the Motor City. He is the Motor City Madman. How are you, Dean?
It's a chilly, chilly morning with the leaves a golden amber, and I'm freezing my ass off, is what I'm trying to say, but, you know, I'll get used to it now that I live in the Motor City.
Now that you are Canadian and grew up in it.
Okay, so living in L.A. and then Australia, your blood really thins out.
You really did very little other than complain about how cold it was in Australia. You spent a lot of shows. I mean, I might, if I had nothing else to do, I might cut together a montage of you complaining about how cold it was in Australia.
Well, to be fair, they don't use insulation down there. So a weird construction method that includes no insulating properties whatsoever in any of the houses.
Might I suggest, with how often you claim to be freezing your ass off, you would be well advised to wear some insulation down under.
My old down under insulation. I have another name for it, but sure.
All right. Well, we'll just scrub clean the first 3 minutes of this show. And
are you kidding? That's comedy gold right there.
Comedy gold. Speaking of which, we are in live events of the week, and you spun some comedy gold on Halloween night. It was full of you showing comedy tricks, and it was received as a great treat by a huge audience of improv enthusiastic. I don't know what take
know.
Over from me. What was it?
Well, you know what? There, it was a delightful show. A great crowd for a rainy, cold Halloween's Eve, and people had come from all over, as far as Grand Rapids, Michigan, to drive all the way to see me. That was lovely, and there was a couple guitar player from George Clinton's band, the Funkadelics.
Wow. Oh,
he was
course.
A Funkadelic. Him and his fiance were just walking, looking for something to do, and on Halloween night, and they saw the poster, the X-Files poster, outside the theater. They came in, loved the show. We had a chat. He's going to be DMing me on the old Twitter feed one of these days. Fantastic. Stories. I think I saw him play in New York in Central Park at a free concert back in the 80s. When was I there? 80s, 90s. And, you know, I enjoyed the Funkadelics live years ago and probably saw him on the guitar. How weird is that?
That's very exciting. It's exciting it is, right? That we both have live events of the week to share. And they both peripherally involve iconic musical performers from our youths. But yes, that Parliament Funkadelic, I mean, we are the mothership. Let's just put it that way. We, when it comes to Funkadelic podcasts, this is the mothership. I don't know.
That's true.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. Okay, I want to hear how that was true. I'm shocked. I mean, you actually said that was true while meaning it was true. So how in the name of hell is what I just said true?
Because we are the Freeform Jazz podcasting now for going on our 13th year. In the longest running free show of unscripted mayhem. So very much like there's a baseline, they know their songs, and then there's a lot of improvisation.
Wow. Okay. Free flowing mayhem.
Right.
I mean, we probably would have a bigger audience if that had been the title of the show all these years.
All right. You got to change it again?
No. No.
There's going to be a lawsuit.
No, we're not. Free flowing mayhem. Okay. So anything else about the one man improv X-File show that you did on Halloween night?
No, it went to the oddly enough, the last person I brought up on stage, who worked in extruded aluminum car parts for a Japanese company, happened to be very good friends of friend of the show and friend here in Detroit, Matty Giles, and his girlfriend Amber. Their best friend, unbeknownst to me, came to the show, came late. He was hilarious from Knoxville, Tennessee, brought him up on stage. His name was Alex. And then he posted a picture on his Facebook, and then Matt goes, "Hey, you brought my best friend up on stage. How weird is that? What a small town I'm suddenly living in."
Right.
Motown's a small town.
Well, I mean, the weirdest part about it was that Maddie needed to see a photo on social media to see that it was his best friend and couldn't tell live in the audience that it was his best friend.
It was Amber's birthday. So
okay. That was the section of the show where someone we know gets thrown under the bus. It was Halloween week, of course, and I got my fill of Halloween. I mean, I went to parties, you know, costume parties, pumpkin carving parties, the Breakfast Club Halloween shindig, where Charles Phoenix came and spoke. That was a huge turnout, huge success. But maybe the most memorable for Halloween 2019 for me will be going to the Magic Castle on Monday night to see some close-up magic and to do some drinking. And
yes.
Of course, Magic Castle is a members-only club, but we were guests of the particular magician we wanted to go see. And it was interesting how much, again, when you were talking about your show this week, I was reminded of some real similarities, at least in the show I saw. It was, I don't know, similar is the right word, but simpatico with your approach to your improv show. This performer, Zabrecki, the great Zabrecki, whose real name is Rob Zabrecki, who many right. people might remember was the front man for the great band Possum Dixon. And 20 years ago, he left music, left punk music, to explore his love of magic. And one of the only magicians to ever fool, I think, Penn and Teller on their show. He's really, really good and so funny, but also a great actor. And in close-up magic, how important is that? I mean, I don't mean just a showman. Obviously a showman, right? And you think of that. You think of the showmanship of magic. But up close in a more intimate setting, it's a little bit of a different form of showmanship. I would literally say that it's about acting. And but one of the things that he did that I loved with you know, the volunteers that he would pick from the audience. So much of what I knew, you know, about picking people from the audience, I would see that he was employing, you know, the same techniques you do when picking people from the audience, right? You know, who are you looking for? Who are you trying to avoid? These kind of things. But he said something at one point when somebody came up and they were getting blindfolded, and you know, he kind of whispered to her. He said, "You know, no, don't worry, stay calm. No one's going to harm you. No one's going to embarrass you." And I thought that was such a sweet thing to say. I'd never heard anybody say that. In you know, in that kind of milieu before, no one's going to embarrass you. And you really saw the woman, you know, relax a little bit. Her shoulders went down, and her because that is a fear, right? A fear not that someone is going to embarrass you, but that embarrassment is going to be part of the piece of it.
Right.
And indeed, you're reaching out. You are gravitating towards those people that have a certain innate shyness or an innate sense of shame, let's say a healthy sense of shame, the sort of person that is worried about being embarrassed because they're not the people that are getting up there to show you how funny they are. They're not getting up there to be discovered.
Right, right. So this this is a common phenomenon. And in fact, it is the basis of stage fright in general, is that you are predicting or pre-guessing what the audience reaction is going to be. And, you know, and so it's this fear loop that goes on where you are assuming the group of people you're standing in front will judge you harshly or make fun of you or whatever thing. And it amplifies into your head where you have then suddenly crippling stage fright and can't go on. So yes, and by being blindfolded, I can see why he has, I'm sure he learned that very early on, maybe after the second time he blindfolded someone and the first time it didn't go well, was that there one of your senses is taken away. So now you are, if you are in a stage fright fear predicting loop and you can't see their reaction, then your fright doubles or quadruples even.
So I was able, this is not a in any way to comment on the quality of Zabrecki's work. He is amazing, and I would want to see him again and again and again. I think in a 30-minute set, maybe, I mean, I don't know how many, off the top of my head, how many bits that he did, but I think there were two that I did not immediately see how they were being done. There were only two. And the reason I say that is because it's, I'm sure, related to a project that we're starting to work on. You and I. That my mind is really in that way of thinking. Because... Right. So we're going to be working on a screenplay that is set in part in the world of live magic performing, and I've been thinking about what kind of tricks might work best for camera that can be done in such a way where they can be done quickly enough and in masters so that an audience would know they're not using film techniques to make it work. Because isn't that, if we could do that, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
Anyway, but because of that, I think I'm really looking at things in a much different way. And and it's not more enjoyable. Let me, you know, but what it did do is those ones where I go, oh my God, how does he do that? Are even more powerful, right? And there were there was one that I was tricked. But you know what I love, and I wanted to just see if you'd ever thought about this before, when you'd seen magic or you know, performed anywhere. You know, we all know the idea of like forcing a card on someone, right?
Right.
Like pick a card, any card. Well, no, you're picking the card that they want you to pick.
Right.
I love this concept of forcing an idea on someone.
Oh.
You know, like mind reading tricks or those sort of things. Yeah. Forcing an idea onto
someone. The Amazing Kreskin was the master at that.
What a great concept to explore, because, I mean, is this not the basis of so much media manipulation?
Well, that's the thing, right? Propaganda, media manipulation,
marketing, all of that. Advertising, politics.
Yes, planting an idea in your head
That you think is yours,
right?
That you think originates with you.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's that. Old, it wasn't even a joke. We did this in junior high. You ask about, I guess, 3 to 5 math questions where the answer is always 48. So what's 8 plus 40? 48. And you just have them repeat 48 about 5 times, and then ask them what their name any vegetable. And almost 99% of the time, they say carrots.
Okay. Well, that's very similar to a trick that was performed, and it's still so good. I mean, and the audience reaction is so good. And again, the flourishes, the acting, you know, the atmosphere, so good. And like I said, the trick that the answer to which was staring literally right in front of me the whole time, even before the show, when I was hanging out talking with Zabrecki, the answer to the finale was right in front of my nose the whole time. And I didn't see it coming. And it was so good. One of those tricks that's so good, it makes me angry.
Yeah. Well, now you hit on why I don't go to magic. Not only is it good, but when it's really good, I'm so pissed off I can't figure it out. I just get mad at the performer, mad at myself.
It's not because I can't figure it out. I mean, I don't generally want to figure it out. It's not like I was trying to figure it out. It's just the answers were coming to me because I've been in that mindset now for a couple months as we ruminate on this. It's just when anything is really good, it makes me angry. anything. You know, like this cake is so good, it makes me angry. I mean, it's what comes forward in me, it feels a lot like anger. Okay. All right.
You're packed with rage. You live a life of luxury and it's all enraging you.
So that was great fun. And of course, drinking and God, so many bars in the Magic Castle. That's what's really fun. I like any house, any old Victorian house that has several bars on every floor. So that was great fun. And Zabrecki couldn't really hang out with us afterwards, but he did take the time to introduce us to guests of his who had seen one of his earlier shows and finally got to meet someone whose path we had almost crossed on numerous occasions. The wonderful Allison Martino, who's she's a Spectrum News host here in Los Angeles. But that didn't make her be this. Rather, it took advantage of this, which is that she is someone who has long had the desire to explore the best, most interesting, most unusual of Los Angeles, and really had a great keen sense for what might really be something that could capture Angelino's imaginations that they perhaps didn't know existed in their town. So really, I mean, especially someone who had, so much to talk about with Lily and just a stylish lady. If I am correct, I'm going to say it one way or another, but I think I might be correct about this, daughter of the great singer Al Martino, actually. But anyway, made new friends, which ordinarily, Dean, you know, I hate doing. And there's nothing I hate more. What a fun way, though, really, to celebrate Halloween. And of course, packed to the rafters, even on a Monday night, with people dressed in costumes. And though I will tell you this, a lot of fun, great place to go for Halloween. I love Halloween in a way I think you probably don't. But I will say, if any place didn't need to be a costume party, it's the Magic Castle, right? If any place didn't need Halloween decorations, it's the Magic Castle. Just give me the normal Magic Castle on a nighttime with people being expected to dress up in the manner according to the code and custom of the Magic Castle. That would be immersive enough of all that I love of Halloween. So instead, it wasn't quite as magical an evening as usual at the Magic Castle, you know, because people don't have to pay attention to the dress code because they can wear any shitty costume they want on Halloween.
Right. But anyway. What a drag, right?
So I just threw that in because, you know, I don't like to deal strictly in the positive. All right. And that we go from the undead to the sadly simply dead with celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Let's talk a little bit about the comedy of John Witherspoon, shall we?
Shall we?
I was thinking about Witherspoon this past week because I had seen, right, last week I'd seen Dolomite Is My Name, which you saw this week. And I was thinking about the fact that it was kind of shocking that in a long movie career, the only actor in that huge ensemble, that impressive, talented ensemble in Dolomite Is My Name, the only member of that ensemble that Eddie Murphy had ever worked with before was Chris Rock. And I had to remind Eddie Murphy of that at the screening that I went to because he didn't think he had worked with anyone. And I said, Chris Rock, Boomerang. It was an Eddie Murphy movie I really liked when that came out. I've always thought it kind of has been given short shrift historically. The comedy might be a little uncomfortable in the Me Too era, but it really is about a man behaving a certain way, getting his comeuppance. But, you know, in the early 90s there. And it really helped launch Halle Berry. I mean, it helped launch Chris Rock. It helped... David Alan Grier. So a really wonderful cast in that movie. You know, Chris Rock was in a kind of a small role back then, but also John Witherspoon. And yeah. I so fondly remember John Witherspoon's performance from that film. I guess he, of course, became known to probably a new generation who never even saw his stand-up for playing Ice Cube's grouchy father in the Friday franchise.
Right.
Movies.
Also, he was the voice in The Boondocks, wasn't he? The animated series that included our friend Gary Anthony Williams?
Yes, and so that's probably another generation that gets to know him, right?
Right.
He started in movies, believe it or not. I mean, this is a great trivia question. John Witherspoon's first movie, Dean, do we know what that was? His
Let's see, his first movie. Good Lord. What would it be?
1980.
What? 1980. Disney? Is it a Disney movie?
No, but I like that you're going kind of in an unexpected terrain. It was The Jazz Singer, the Neil Diamond.
Oh, my God, you're kidding.
Remake of The Jazz Singer. Isn't that amazing?
The terrible remake.
Then he, you know, he really makes his mark, though, in movies like Boomerang, which I mentioned, but also Hollywood Shuffle, right? Robert Townsend's rather landmark indie film. But what I'm curious about is Witherspoon's stand-up. Were you familiar with his stand-up?
I was not. I had heard that he'd done stand-up. I think I saw him once at the Improv, you know, on a Wednesday or Thursday night where hundreds of comics rotate through and all do five. I never saw a full set where it was polished and performed. I heard he was hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him, you know, do undoubtedly sanitized versions of some of his material on, you know, the late night shows. Right. I think on Letterman, I think, you know, Late Night, the old NBC show that he did. But yeah, I never saw him do a set in a club, and I imagine he was quite a presence on stage in a club.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because he was a presence everywhere. I mean, just the fun, dynamic energy, you know, the type.
And of course, that dynamic energy lent itself to appearing in, you know, so many sitcoms of the right. 70s, right? Good Times, for example, WKRP. Though his first television appearance, again, I was going to say that this is kind of surprising. But now I'm realizing not. Anyway, his first TV appearance was in the old police procedural Barnaby Jones.
Wow.
Which, of course, starred Barnaby a former Jones. Comedic actor, right? Mr. Clampett, right? Didn't he star in Barnaby Jones, the guy from Beverly Hillbillies? Yeah.
Yeah.
But, of course, I think Witherspoon played a camp counselor for addicted youth in that TV show. But where was I going with all this? There was something about his stand-up that I wanted to mention, but anyway, I just imagine that, yeah, I just the thought of getting to be in a intimate club setting with that guy holding the stage is kind of a delightful thought. So I'm gonna maybe try to seek out some of his club sets, see if there's anywhere, any, at least from the 80s, any video or anything of it. We'll point out a Motown native, born in Detroit, Michigan.
Oh, look at that. Yeah. See?
No,
big deal.
Detroit's very own. So I bet if you went to any of these comedy clubs, I mean, you might go to Go Comedy and find that they're comedic flags are at half mast. I don't even know what that means, but I do know.
I don't know if comedic flags fly.
I don't even know if they are freezing down under. So, all right. You can talk about icons. You can talk about legends. There's icons. There's legends. And then there's Robert Evans, who I feel was kind of his own category altogether. Bob Evans, an American film producer and studio executive, whose movies that he was responsible for overseeing in those capacities include Rosemary's Baby, Love Story, The Godfather, Chinatown. He died at 89.
Wow.
And he began his career, I mean, I don't know what's more bizarre. You tell me about how he began his career or how he ended his career. He began his career in a very successful business venture with his brother selling women's apparel.
What?
I
did not know that.
Oh, you did? You saw the documentary? Right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So
yes,
you
the
did
kid stays
that.
In the picture.
Yes, so you did know that, is what you're saying.
I forgot that.
In 1956, while on a business trip, he was spotted by chance by actress Norma Shearer. This was in the in the documentary, and who thought he would be right to play the role of her late husband. Do you remember? Do you remember who he bore a resemblance to?
Late husband of Norma Shearer is...
Famous guy.
Famous? Holy smokes. I didn't know there'd be a
okay. Irving Thalberg.
Irving Thalberg, right.
So
famous producer, the Thalberg Award.
Right. So an early film mogul in Man of a Thousand Faces. So his whole career in show business is launched by playing a mogul. I mean, how great is that?
That's totally.
It leads to a brief film acting career. And in 1962, he decides to go into film producing instead, using his accumulated wealth from his clothing business, and subsequently had a meteoric rise as a producer that he did not experience as a director, right? By 1967, 5 years later, after deciding, you know what, acting's not for me, let's go to producing. 5 years later, he's installed as the head of Paramount Pictures.
And, isn't that amazing?
And this was still at a time where when you could be installed as the head of one of these companies, you could actually direct not only you know, the slate of films, but direct to the how business was done and whether or not that company was successful. I'm not sure these big corporations really, you know, one person can come in for the amount of time that they're there and have that kind of impact anymore. But this was still an age where they wanted moguls, for crying out loud. And so he improved Paramount's fortunes because Paramount was ailing financially. I mean, everything that's old is new again. Here we are 50 years later, and they're right back there. But he you know, launched a slate of films that would not only be commercially successful but critically acclaimed. Paramount Pictures was, to me, Hollywood filmmaking of the 70s and early 80s. And in 1974, he stepped down to produce his own films again. And part of his contract with Paramount had been that he could produce as an independent producer while still drawing a salary as the head of the studio. He could independently produce one film a year. And the first time he does this, it's Chinatown. And the success of that, at least in terms of all the Oscars, makes him realize how much he misses just being a producer.
Wow.
So he steps down to produce his own films. In 1980, his career and life took a bit of a downturn after he pleads guilty to cocaine trafficking.
That's a bit of a downturn.
Now, in all fairness, it's 1980. I think most of us didn't even know there were laws against that.
I think we did know there were laws against
Certainly those who came of age in Hollywood. I mean, when he first comes to Hollywood in the 1950s, the San Fernando Valley was nothing but grove after grove of cocaine trees. So,
well, this is why it's so surprising he made it to 89. The abuse, as documented, seemed to would have rendered anyone else liver deficient or something.
All right, I'm not going to tell. I'm not going to name names, but he maintained a shingle. Robert Evans did on the Paramount lot for the next 12, 13 years as an independent producer, and I got to visit his offices one day because someone who was working for them was a friend of mine and would become a collaborator on a film and on my first film. And so I went in to meet him and, you know, to have lunch on the Paramount lot and, you know, walk around. And so I'm waiting inside Evan's suite of offices. And as far as I can tell at first, everyone has like some sort of urinary tract infection because they're all getting up to go to the bathroom really quite often. And you know, this is one of those things where I showed up early because you don't want to be late. And also you want to soak in the atmosphere of the studio. But then, as so much often does, a supposed emergency comes up. So I'm waiting for about an hour. And that's fine because you're in Robert Evans' office in Paramount Studios, for crying out loud. But everybody was going to the bathroom a lot. And not only did they have a urinary tract infection, but they were all suffering from seasonal allergies, apparently, because they all came out of the bathroom, rubbing their nose and sniffing and eyes watering. And I mean, sure enough, finally, I got around to needing to go to the bathroom and, oh, look, there's crushed up Tylenol for use everywhere. Yeah. And that's early 90s, man.
Look at that.
So
that is crazy.
He produces in those first 12 years there only after the drug trafficking, only two films. And they're both famous and they're both financial flops. And they're both, I think, primed for reappraisal and enjoyment. The first we talked about last week, The Cotton Club.
Right.
Which is now out in its full form, Cotton Club Encore. It's a must see, and we'll dedicate a great deal of time to it when we re-welcome to the show Tucker Smallwood in the coming weeks, where Tucker's going to talk about his work with Coppola, working as an advisor on Apocalypse Now, and being a cast member of Cotton Club. and all that he witnessed. But of course, Robert Evans developed Cotton Club as a project for himself to direct.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Using mob money to make the film.
Right.
And it didn't go well, and he realized he needed a director. So he called a favor in, and that's how Coppola becomes involved. And that's how the script starts to get rewritten. I heard at one point there was something like 40 different scripts that different departments were using as they headed production on this. Yeah. So many different versions of it, so many different writers, all brilliant. But what a mess that was. And then the other one was Bob Evans produces the sequel to Chinatown. He produces The Two Jakes, which I think is a really criminally underappreciated movie. A movie that does rely heavily, obviously, on your affection for the original Chinatown for its emotional impact. But that's okay. You know, to rely on your love of a character to further explore that character, that's all right. I would say that the only real weakness in Two Jakes is the music score. It's, the original Chinatown music score by Jerry Goldsmith is so terrific. And
yeah,
the score is so lacking in Two Jakes. But I think a very, very good film, a very well-produced film, and... again, a film that Robert Evans starts to develop as his way of getting back into acting, because the idea was always that Two Jakes would be the sequel to Chinatown, and that the second Jake, the first Jake being, of course, Jack Nicholson, the second Jake would be played by Bob Evans.
Wow.
And but the years had taken some of their toll by the time they make it, and so Harvey Keitel ends up playing the part. Anyway, he goes on to make films on a more regular basis in the 90s with a mixed track record. Again, flops like Jade, which was a notorious film at its time, got a lot of publicity, but not much business. And then a film that his final film didn't get a lot of publicity, but did a lot of business, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. That was his final credit, which leads us to the final chapter of his career. We mentioned the documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture, based on his own memoir. It turns him into a pop culture icon, not just because of the stories and the screen presence he is and the way that he narrates it from passages of his own book, but the style of that movie, of photos through the years coming to life.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Think about that.
And then, for a brief period of time, he becomes the star of an American adult animated sitcom.
Yes.
That airs for 2 months on Comedy Central called Kid Notorious.
Right.
The documentary was The Kid Stays in the Picture, and then it's Kid Notorious. And it focused on Evans as himself. The plots were bizarre and absurdist. His best friend is Slash, playing himself. Guitarist Slash.
Yeah.
And they would often feature Evans as himself, as a real life James Bond type character.
Right. But also on a lot of drugs.
Why do you say
Bond?
I
mean,
because James Bond isn't, but really, if James Bond were a real guy, I'm betting
he'd be on a lot of drugs.
Yeah. Hmm. Don't you think?
Yeah, probably.
A lot of painkillers, if nothing else. And he is. I mean, what does Ian Fleming, the alcohol, the remember, he's a chronic smoker in the books.
Oh,
and,
yeah, that's
and,
right.
And the wanton sex. I mean, those are all painkillers, right?
Yeah. Well, now you're bumming me out about James Bond.
Yeah, I bet there's heroin track marks there. I'm just telling you. I'm just saying. Anyway, there will never, ever, we say this from time to time, there will never, ever be a Robert Evans ever again, because the world has just changed, the business has just changed too dramatically. Bob Evans. There will be other colorful figures, to be sure, but none like Robert Evans.
That's right. Yeah, well.
All right, so you saw The Dolomite Is My Name. Do you want to share some thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with many of the things that you said. what a difference it is when he's really invested in the project, when he's actually loving doing what he's doing. And you really miss that Eddie Murphy energy, don't you? I mean, you think of Pluto Nash or Dave or the ones that he just phoned in, and you're like, God, was, you know, you forgot he was ever funny until this movie. And you went, oh my God.
You know, he was just early on in the 80s, even if we go to some of the hits that weren't good, you know, the time when Eddie Murphy, young Eddie Murphy, could get any movie made, and so he did.
Right.
I remember specifically Beverly Hills Cop 2. Beverly Hills Cop 1 becomes, I think, the biggest hit of that year. I think it's even bigger than, I don't know, the Ghostbusters. I think it's the biggest R-rated film of all time at that point. An enormous hit. And famously was not supposed to star Eddie Murphy. It was a vehicle for Sylvester Stallone. And he drops out, you know, relatively close to filming. So Eddie Murphy steps in. And Eddie Murphy brings a lot. There are writers who are rewriting as they're going to tailor it more for Eddie Murphy. But Eddie Murphy's bringing a lot of his own stuff and, bringing a lot of the humor to it. But that movie worked because it worked as an actioner and it was funny. And this, seems like a no-brainer, but this was an age before every comedy had to be an action movie, right? We were coming out of the 70s where action movies were hardcore. They were gritty. They were suspenseful. And this idea of a comedic action movie, not something that was being released to theaters every week. All right. So I remember Eddie Murphy being on Johnny Carson's show. And when the week that Beverly Hills Cop 2 is coming out. And he says, if you loved Beverly Hills Cop 1, you're really going to love Beverly Hills Cop 2. Because this time it was written for me. And I'm sitting there going, well, that makes sense. I loved Beverly Hills Cop. I'm going to love Beverly Hills Cop 2 all the more. And damn it, Beverly Hills Cop 2 didn't seem like a Sylvester Stallone movie.
Right.
And, interesting. And it was because, in part, the director, Tony Scott, who makes action films, not comedies, versus Martin Brest, who had been coming off of Going in Style, the caper comedy starring George Burns, and was going to go into one of the great action comedies of all time, Midnight Run. Someone, in other words, with comedy chops. But that in itself, you know that Eddie Murphy handpicked the director at that point already in his career, still in his 20s. He's producing this stuff. He's calling the shots. And so many of his decisions reflected a, shall we say, youthful arrogance.
Yeah.
But the shocking thing was his performances reflected the youthful arrogance themselves. And
that he didn't.
And that cut into the comedy.
Yeah.
Arrogance is different than confidence. And so flash forward to Dolomite Is My Name. It's a great performance. It's an all-time performance. I think it's only a kind of performance that he could give because it requires to play Rudy Ray Moore, whose chief attribute, whose chief talent was confidence.
Right.
It requires someone who can believably embody and bring to bear full confidence. And yet it also requires an Eddie Murphy, a performer, who's willing to be vulnerable and humble. It's that combination that makes this performance not only work, but gives the film so much heart.
That's the thing. It's got so much heart, right? I mean, as ridiculous as some of the filmmaking thing, like make the bedroom set really great because I'm moving in. Giving up my apartment to make that movie, that, you know, that would be seeming ridiculous, but the way they play is like, it's just a matter of fact. Absolutely. I'm going to be living on set. So, that kind of heart, but it's not stamped with a gold stamp going, look at the heart in this thing. it is kind of thrown away. It's just permeated in its DNA. It's amazing, actually.
Yeah. So it's a great. Do you think? I mean, I know the adage is comedy performances for leads don't get Oscar nominations. And maybe maybe I'm just hoping against hope. Maybe it's a pie in the eye hope in the face of that. But I can't watch the Eddie Murphy's performance in Dolomite without thinking not only is this a great achievement for him, but no other actor could do this. And I'm not asking you if he deserves it. But
will the Academy?
Yeah, will they? Knowing that Netflix has quite the machine behind them to promote this, knowing also how much I think people look, Sylvester Stallone, who is not well liked, nevertheless, people wanted him to have a comeback so badly that they nominated him for playing Rocky again, right? In Creed. They didn't let him win because they were reminded how much they didn't like him during the award season. But I don't know. And I don't even know if it matters. But do you think that he could?
Yeah, I think he could because, you know, to my mind, underlying it, it's a comedy performance only because he's a comedian. He's playing a comedian.
Oh, very good. It's very not, good.
Right? With the transitional moments where he goes to see Front Page with a white audience and they're all laughing hysterically and they're all looking going, what the hell's so funny? But he turns around to look at the light coming out of the projecting booth and has the revelation that he should be in a movie. That dramatic moment is so cool and not funny, but kind of these moments of revelation that Eddie Murphy, the actor, portrays are kind of phenomenal, actually, in terms of acting moments. Like, you all see every movie where, hey, I got an idea, or light bulb goes on in the head. It's always kind of a snap thing. But to see it slowly grow across Eddie Murphy's face and see the machinations in the brain working on how this crazy career of this comedian and how his mind worked, it, to me, is totally endemic of an Oscar.
That's fascinating. Two things. One, yeah, you're right. So it's more Dustin Hoffman as Lenny.
Yes.
Which gets awards because, you know, it's not a comedy performance. It's a performance as a comedian. And there are several scenes like what you're describing now that I think about it. And that's fascinating because you just described, we talked about last week about how it's great to see him work with other talented actors and to be as the wonderful divine Joy Randolph, who plays Lady Reed, to be, as she described, the ultimate scene partner, right? Which he is in this movie for these other actors. But you just described a scene that is about him alone holding center and conveying everything so that when it gets discussed, we go, ah, yes, yes, because we saw it. We may not have been able to put words to what we saw, but once those words were put to it later, we know that's exactly what we saw. And another scene like that is when Lady Reed is introduced. And we see Dolomite backstage looking at one of the, you know, the clubs on the Chitlin circuit, right? Yeah. And he's looking out through the curtains and he sees her and she's about to get in a fight with her cheating husband.
Yeah.
Out in the club. Him. But he sees her first. She's standing alone, a dark cloud in that room. And his eyes go right to her and he watches and we see him watch it. And then he transforms because he immediately, the curtains open and he comes out as Dolomite, right?
Right.
And then afterwards he goes up and he talks to her. And when he talks to her and he says about how, you know, he asks whether she ever has been in show business or would want to be, and she never has. And he basically says, you need to be because you're one of those rare people that brings your own spotlight with you. And we go, oh, that's it. That's what we saw.
Yeah, right.
We saw him appreciating that. That's another thing. So it's amazing because it does combine the Eddie Murphy who's capable of creating on his own with the Eddie Murphy that is capable of being such a giving scene partner. So
yeah, and then I think back to, you know, I think I've told that story where my friend was in an Eddie Murphy movie and never met him. Just all his scenes were with a stand-in, and then they were cleared from set. So Eddie Murphy can do his lines to another stand-in.
Yeah.
And I think now it's out of sheer embarrassment of being in these pieces of shit films mid-career there that maybe he could not look another actor in the eye until he was in a project that he loved, right?
Yeah. Happens. That does happen. I mean, you know, especially interestingly enough for comedic performers. There's something about comedic performers. I mean, I've got stories about Dick Van Dyke, you know, and that Diagnosis Murder show that he did. But there's something where if you're, you know, comically ingrained, that voice of judgment really can make it tough to be picking up the ridiculous paycheck.
Right.
Violins. All right. Hey, there's so many movies that I want to talk about, and we only have a little bit of time, and I'm not really sure how to focus on these because I find myself doing a couple different things, right? I want to stay au courant as we go into award season with everything that I need to see for awards, and I want to see everything that could make a year-end list as I do every year. But of course, we're approaching the end of the decade, so I'm also, I made that short list of the 600 best films of the decade, and I'm seeing the going through and seeing. I think I have 25 more left that I haven't seen of those 600, and I'm trying to rewatch all the 50 or so on the short list that I made that had a potential to make my decade list. So I'm doing all these things, and yet then I added a third viewing task to it. So it's not just about the best of the year, best of the decade, but in watching one of these best of the decade films that had escaped my attention, a film streaming on Netflix, I suddenly had an epiphany about Palme d'Or winners. And this is, again, the top prize at Cannes. Right?
Right.
It started being given out in 1955. They started giving this out. So that's what, 64 years of the Palme d'Or.
Right.
But they've given out, I think, 74 of them or 73, something around there, because there were some ties during the year.
Right.
There was one year, 68, where they didn't give one because the festival was canceled due to the Paris riots.
Oh.
But I went through and I was shocked to find that I have seen one fewer than half of all Palme d'Or winners. I've seen every Best Picture winner, but one fewer than half of the Palme d'Or winners. And of course, most of these are international films. They're films not in English that I haven't seen. And I figured I would be well served to watch all of these. Once I see Bong Joon-ho's film that came out, I think this Friday, theaters around the country, Parasite, which director we love, and it won Palme d'Or and is being hailed as one of the best of the decade, not just of the year. Once I see that, I will have seen more than half of the Palme d'Or winners. So that's great because that checks off all three boxes. One that is a potential for best of the decade, best of the year, and a Palme d'Or winner. We like those, where I get to make three check marks on my to-do list. But anyway, this is not something that I will, obviously get done before the end of the year with the Palme d'Or, but it would be fun if I could get it done before the next Cannes Film Festival and analyze Palme d'Or winners through the years. But what was the one that led me to think about this? It's because I was researching one of these films that had slipped through that I realized I needed to see before I released a best of the decade list, and it was from Ken Loach, a wonderful director who's always been very interested in the plight of working people. It's a movie called I, Daniel Blake. And it came out in 2016, did fairly well. It starred, it was the screen debut, the big screen debut for a long time veteran British stand-up comic.
What?
Yeah.
How do I not hear of this?
Yeah, I don't know what was going on in 2016 that we didn't know about this. It's an incredible performance by Dave Johns, a stand-up comic, playing the titular character, Daniel Blake. And he is he's a widower. I think he's 59, 60 years old. He's a widower who suffers a massive heart attack. This is all before the movie begins. But he suffers a massive heart attack on a construction site. He's a lifelong construction worker. And so suddenly facing life alone, he's forced to enter the British social welfare state because doctors will not let him work until they can get his heart to pump normally again. So he's got lots of medical tests, a lot of pills. He's got to go through the whole medical system. But he also needs to go through the welfare system to get his benefits to keep him alive. Benefits that are denied him because their panel has decided, their panel independent of doctors and nurses and practitioners, has decided that he doesn't have quite enough health points to qualify as not being able to work. So he has to demand hearings, appeal hearings, right? And so that's the basic premise. And in the meantime, if he wants money, he has to go for unemployment. And to go for unemployment, you have to prove that you're trying to seek work. So he has to try to seek work. And because he is incredibly skilled in certain ways, he gets offered work, which he has to turn down because his doctors won't let him take it, which disqualifies him for the unemployment benefits.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a Kafka-esque comedy drama, truly Kafka-esque. I mean, it is the trial, only the scary thing about it is it's not even a thinly veiled allegory. It is very much about how many social programs, not only in England specifically, but around the world, in the wake of a move, let's say, towards more conservative controls over the last couple decades.
Right.
Where we know that we can't eliminate programs because the programs are beloved, right? We nevertheless can attack them in certain ways, and one of the ways we can attack them is by making them so Byzantine, so Kafka-esque, that the people who need them the most will be so frustrated, so in turmoil by them, that for their own sanity and health, they have to give up the pursuit of their rightly held benefits, and they drop out of the programs altogether.
Right. It's systemic. Well, I guess it's racism, if being poor is a race.
Well, it's a classism, certainly, but also it's ageism. Yeah. It's also ageism, because one of the things that they did in England was they made all these programs be internet-only, all forms internet-only. And this is a working class that has come of age that, in the case of Daniel Blake, even in the 2010s, has never touched a computer. My father has never touched a computer. He's never sat down at a computer.
Wow.
So there are still these people. They're obviously dying out. And sadly, many of them might be dying out quicker because they're not given the help that they need. And this could lead us down a rabbit hole of all sorts of issues. But what a wonderful topic, worthy of exploration. And I loved this movie, but I loved the movie not because of its politics. Yeah, sure, its politics and its humanity are obviously in the right place, but this performance by this stand-up comic turned actor calling on a life of observation and experience is spectacular. You remember when Richard Farnsworth, lifelong stuntman, first gives an acting performance in The Gray Fox? Right?
Yes.
It's that kind of thing. It's like, man, or Dexter Gordon, lifelong jazz musician, giving his first acting performance in Round Midnight. You know,
right.
These people who have that ability to call upon their life's experience to bring to bear on this first performance, and you suddenly go, where the hell has this person been on screen all my life?
Right.
It's such a great performance, and it's so touching, and it is funny because this is a guy who is committed to not being a victim, not being a victim of circumstances, not being a victim of the system, and somebody who is able to look around and always see that, you know, everyone has problems. And maybe if I'm growing frustrated with how my problems are not being aided by others, maybe I will alleviate the pain of that by helping other people with their problems. And so that's what he
Isn't
does.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, it's a beautiful film. And like I said, it's funny, it's heartbreaking, it's shocking.
You're watching it on Netflix?
And it's streaming on Netflix. Daniel Blake. So I urge everyone, former Palme d'Or winner, to check that out. And I think I'm going to end there. I have a lot of other movies I want to talk about, but it'd be fun to give them the time that they deserve, including Taika Waititi's new Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, yes.
A movie that is loved and incredibly hated. So right then, you know, it's got my antenna up as if it didn't already from being from Taika Waititi, who's What We Do in the Shadows, who's Hunt for the Wilder People, who's fucking Thor Ragnarok, for God's sake.
I know, right?
We're all so good. And so we'll talk about Jojo Rabbit next week.
Okay.
And hopefully you will have seen it, because
I'll make it.
There will be a lot for us to talk about. Before we go, I want to ask you real quick, and we'll set this on the table. Have you watched either of the episodes of the new HBO Watchmen?
No, but that's also on my recording list. It's on my DVR.
Were you a fan of the Watchmen graphic novel series?
Yes, I'm actually rereading it right now.
Okay, because I never did read those. I was a fan. It's the, you know, Zack Snyder, who I have criticized so much for his DC movies. I really liked that Watchmen movie. I loved it for the world building, for the alternate world building. I don't know what you would say, but for the world building of it. And I don't know how that worked for people who loved the graphic novel, whether they were fond of his adaptation of it.
Right.
But this Watchmen pulling off a trick of world building within world building, because it's set decades after the events of the Watchmen graphic novel series with all new characters.
Amazing.
Amazing. And, it feels like the show we need right now. that I will say. And then the other thing is that the final season of Silicon Valley has launched, and there's been one episode. And this is a great show. This is one of the all-time greats, and it's clearly got a budget now appropriate to one of the all-time greats being given a final send-off. This first episode had a cast of thousands. And yet what I love, true to its spirit, true to the intent not only of these performers, but of its creators, there's this one moment at this giant party, congratulatory party, with hundreds of extras and lots of costumes and, you know, production design and set dressing, a really expensive sequence. And one character rides up on one of those lime scooters that I hate, right?
Yeah.
And in conversation is riding through the party indoors, through the office on this Lime scooter, and while talking to the main character, walks over, grabs the scooter he's riding, and throws it into a recycling dumpster. all without addressing anything. It's literally a throwaway gag.
Hilarious.
And the announcement is that for all the money that we're being given and that we're going to spend, don't kid yourself, and all the big plot machinations that often touch on the real world in interesting, funny, unusual ways, it's still the heart of this show is the throwaway gag.
Wow. How great is that?
So that brings us to an end of another installment of, what was it, Freeform Chaos? No, what did you call it? What are we?
Yeah, was it Freeform Chaos?
No, I don't think it was.
I don't think it was.
It was so. Something. It was more than an hour ago, so it was so long we can't remember.
Yes.
Anyway, that's the end of this episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. You know, we're available at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. All other platforms, stay tuned. And write us, if you will, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Agent Summer did recently. We read that email last week. And again, we are looking forward to addressing that topic and giving it the time that it's due about great monologues by female actors in movie history.
Right.
And what else? Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
What could be more fun? Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.